This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and this show is called The People Behind the PhDs. This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome back to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Jay Sanguinetti, who studies consciousness, brain stimulation, and meditation as the Associate Director for Consciousness Studies at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona. There's an overlap of about 10 seconds. We can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs.
Neuroscience lab to learn how to run EEG, analyze the EEG, and a lot of it's like you got to clean the data. When you blink your eyes, you've got noise in the EEG and all this kind of stuff happens. I had no idea. I just kind of had to figure it out. And that was equally scary because I didn't have the confidence really at that point to think I could do something like that, but also totally freeing because every little step I took, I started sort of figuring it out and I started gaining confidence in myself. And that really sort of helped, that sort of hearing what the Dalai Lama had to say and thinking like, I want to do that, whatever the Dalai Lama is talking about, I want to work on that. And then, you know, being able to sort of have a supportive environment where I could gain the confidence to be a researcher, those two things kind of combined. And I just sort of, I found the internal motivation to keep trying. And I'll tell you, it was hard. I mean, I was working, you know, 14-hour days in the lab sometimes. I would just sit there and work on trying to get the EEG to work until I finally figured it out. Hmm.
Wow, that's incredible. So eventually you moved on to a different university after, is this UNC Wilmington? Is that where you're going to?
Yep, I was at UNC Wilmington at the beach. Yep, and then I actually ended up working, I took a year off because I thought I wanted to go to grad school, but still I didn't really have the confidence for that. So you can see the theme in my life.
Yeah,
this is why meditation has helped, actually. But I didn't, you know, and I'd never thought I was going to go to graduate school. And my academic path going from high school to college wasn't like, you know, a typical person who's planning to go to grad school from high school, they do everything, they get all their ducks lined up, and they get all the right grades. I didn't do any of that. My GPA in high school was like 2.5 or something like that.
Right, yeah.
It was really bad.
So hugging the middle of the curve there, yeah.
Right, I had to really, you know, the decision to go to graduate school meant I needed to do a lot at the end there to really make myself look good. So I did an honors thesis at the very end of graduate school or undergraduate. And then I took a year off to kind of figure out, do I really want to go to graduate school? And I worked in a lab to kind of build up my resume. So I continued to work with Dr. Keith. And I also worked with Lloyd Smith, the guy who donated the EEG, to kind of get a sense of whether I wanted to be in the business world. Lloyd ran a business where he was actually selling EEG systems to researchers. And although I loved working for Lloyd, he's a very awesome guy and a great mentor, I was actually going to science conferences. So actually the Society for Neuroscience meeting where I saw the Dalai Lama, the next year I was a vendor there. I was actually setting up a booth and was actually selling EEG equipment to the researchers. And I was on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, and I was sort of miserable in a certain sense because I was seeing all of this awesome science being presented, and I wasn't contributing to it, and I wasn't part of it, other than selling the equipment, which is very important, actually. You know, the scientists need the right equipment. But there was something in me that really wanted to be back on the academic path. And I think everyone around me, including my boss, Lloyd, he knew it. You know, they were looking at me like, you need to get back into thinking about graduate school and you need to just do everything. So I continued to work in the lab. I built up my resume and then I applied to graduate school that next year. And honestly, I didn't think I was going to get into one program. And I ended up getting into seven programs, something like that. And part of it, I think, is because I put my story in my letter. You know, you have to write this letter of interest to the graduate schools. And, you know, in that letter, I basically just told the story I just told, which is I've really been following my heart and my nose, you know. And I'm not trying to be a scientist because I want to get a PhD and feel good. I'm trying to be a scientist because I'm deeply interested in consciousness and the nature of consciousness. And, you know, I've been meditating and my own consciousness is changing. And what does that mean? You know, and how do I empirically study that instead of just intuitively study it, or, you know, however else you could.
Did you have a moment, because I'm listening to that story and thinking about people who might think about applying for grad school someday. Was there a moment of courage? You know, I always think in terms of stepping through courage or stepping into it, where you said, I'm going to have to reveal myself and I'm just going to go for it, even though I feel vulnerable about it. Was there any hesitation for you? Because that's a powerful thing, is to really share some deep thoughts you had with people you didn't know. Because most people might approach these letters of interest and say, I need to talk about, you know, my resume and, you know, kind of name drop a lot and all these other things. But you had a kind of a different approach. You just sort of said very powerfully, this is who I am.
Yep. Yeah, that was actually scary to do, because I, you know, like you do, I downloaded a bunch of previous, you know, people who had previously gotten into graduate school. They'll post their letters online and I read them. And, you know, most of them read, like you said, they kind of set it up in a sort of logical, like, here's what I've done, here's all the other cool stuff I've done. And that just didn't feel right to me. You know, I really wanted to tell the story and give the narrative. And, you know, part of that was I was going to graduate school to continue that narrative. I wasn't going to graduate school just to tick off another mark on my achievement list, right? Yeah. I was going to graduate school with a very specific reason. And so I wanted to tell that story, because if they didn't want that story, I didn't want to go to grad school. You know, and I really was looking at it that way. Like, I'm putting myself out there, honestly, and if the graduate committees or the professors don't like it, then I'm going to do that some other way. You know, and I kind of really, I had that intention in my head. My intention was to really study consciousness. And if the academic world said no, for whatever reason, then I was going to find another way.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com.
And I kind of in my head had decided to that I wasn't going to get in. You know, I kind of let go in a certain sense of graduate school when I wrote that letter. And somehow through letting go and not being so attached to the prize of getting into graduate school, I was able to sort of really tell, sort of say what I wanted to say. But yeah, that was very hard. I started my letter off actually talking about Immanuel Kant, who's a philosopher who kind of started the way of thinking about cognitive systems, you know, not in the brain, but in philosophy. And so it was a very unusual way to start out a letter applying to a neuroscience program, you know, talking about Immanuel Kant's 300, 400-year-old philosopher, I think 300 years. You know, it's kind of strange, but I think the committee liked that because it was unusual, and they probably get a lot of very similar letters written to them.
Absolutely, absolutely. So where did you end up going?
I ended up going to the University of Arizona for my PhD. And so like I said, I got into a lot of different programs, and it was a very hard choice. But again, for me, it came back to really listening to why I was going to graduate school. What did I want out of graduate school? And what was the thing I wanted to study? And the University of Arizona has a first-class philosophy program, and they also have this center called the Center for Consciousness Studies, which has sort of a famous, long-time-running conference on consciousness. And so I went there not just for the neuroscience program or the psychology program that I got into, but also because it was sort of the environment where I thought I would have the most chance of running into people who were interested in consciousness. And again, that was a big risk because U of A is a great school, but it wasn't the most prestigious school I got into. I actually got into some very prestigious schools. But when I went to interview them, when you get into graduate school, you go fly and you interview with the people and you get to meet them and meet the graduate students, meet the professors. And when I went to these prestigious schools, I would tell them my story, like I'm interested in consciousness and I got to see the Dalai Lama, and they were like, oh yeah, that's fine. Consciousness is just a silly thing that, undergraduates are interested in or something, right? Mm. And I was like, no, that's what I'm going to study. And so actually, it was when I went to the University of Arizona where it really felt like kind of home, where I would tell them this is what I'm interested in, and they would say, oh, well, then you need to talk to this person, and they actually had like people I should meet, and it just felt more open to being kind of in this sort of weird neuroscience philosophy space that I wanted to be in.
So then what were your focus? I mean, obviously you're interested in consciousness and helping people. What were your foci? What were your areas of focus when you got to University of Arizona? What was?
So I knew that, and some of my mentors, like Dr. Keith, told me that, it's going to be hard to start a career just studying consciousness. Even at that point, it was a little difficult to have your career built around that. Now, that was becoming more acceptable, but the lead up to that, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, as a psychologist or a neuroscientist, you couldn't even say the word consciousness. They would, kick you out of the lecture hall, right? It was, a dirty word. So we're still dealing with a little bit of that baggage, but I knew that I was going to have to study something a little more practical and sort of tractable if I wanted to study it. So I actually got really interested in visual perception.
Je peux le voir.
Perception. So studying the visual system and how does the visual system create visual consciousness? So that's sort of a more bite-sized question, right? Instead of how does the brain create consciousness in general, you can just study the visual system and try to figure out how the visual system pulls out visual objects from the input, from the eyeballs, things like that. So I got into a program with Mary Peterson, who's a professor in the psychology department, and John J.B. Allen. I had two advisors. I think they must have figured out I was kind of a wild horse or something, and I'd have to have two advisors instead of one. Mary just has a really beautiful program of looking at basic visual perception or the sort of early stages of visual perception and how those early stages interact with what you might consider more cognitive levels of consciousness. So she's got this very nice model that she's been working on for a long time, looking at how these things interact in the brain. And so, that really seemed like a great entry point for me, to have some sort of scientifically tractable question about consciousness and visual awareness and a way to sort of really parse that out.
Okay, what about the other person, John, you said?
Yeah, John J.B. Allen, he is an expert in electrophysiology, so studying different ways of biopotentials, EEG from the head, EKG, taking the heart beat, and making inferences about physiological function from the heartbeat. He's one of the world experts in that. He is an amazing methodologist in that kind of stuff. And he really is an expert in processing EEG data to find the proper signals for whatever question you're interested in. Excuse me. And so really sort of combining John's knowledge of electrophysiology with Mary's knowledge, visual perception, helped me to really ask questions about visual consciousness, but ask it from a brain perspective. What is the brain doing when you perceive visual objects, for example? And how do we test that? And how quickly, I really got interested in questions about the timing of vision. And how quickly can the brain process something you see on the screen, you know, just kind of things like that.
Oh, wow. So what now? I mean, what are you doing now? Obviously, you are in meditation. Are you studying meditation now?
I am sort of going down that path. Interestingly, my meditation practice increased all through grad school. It waxed and waned. So, you know, when I stopped meditating, I became more anxious and it became clear. In graduate school, it can give you a lot of anxiety, as you know.
Yes, I do.
And so, you know, then I would meditate. I would go to retreats. I lived with a person, Tucker Peck, who's now a meditation teacher, but he was always encouraging me to meditate. I would meditate with Tucker. And then my anxiety would go down, and I would say, okay, I got to do more of this. And so it was always kind of a personal practice. But, you know, I never thought actually I would study it formally. I always thought it would be something that I would integrate into my science. And maybe I would use it as a way to study consciousness.
The people behind the PhDs are stories of man versus himself and woman versus herself. How do they find the strength to achieve their goals? Let's continue listening.
I actually, in graduate school, sort of a side thing that I got interested in was brain stimulation. So this is any way of putting something into the brain to modulate brain function. And in the beginning, the way I got interested in this was actually during surgery. So somehow I got back into the operating room, even though I hate being in the operating room. This time it was at a hospital, so these were human surgeries. And they put electrodes down into the brain of Parkinson's patients to the part that's where they kind of generate those tremors. You know, if you watch Michael J. Fox, you can see his hand like shaking in a certain rhythm.
Yeah.
So they have a surgery now where they put a little tiny microscopic electrode. Well, not microscopic, but it's, you know, millimeter size. And they put it down in that part of the brain. So they put a hole and they actually just drill a hole. It looks like a drill that you would get at like Home Depot or something, I swear. I mean, it's better than that, of course, but you know, they drill into the head, and then they just put this little electrode down, and they turn it on. And as soon as they turn it on, I mean, I swear it's like a miracle. Like, the patient is awake. I was in the operating room watching these things happen. And as soon as they put that little electrode down in the brain and turn it on, the patient's hand stops tremoring.
Wow.
And they just, usually they have this sort of rigidity in their hand. It's like kind of crumpled up.
Yeah.
And then they find another parameter. They kind of have to tune the thing because it's pulsing. And they find the right pulse parameter, and then their hand can open up, and they can actually, like, grab for the first time in years. I mean, it's like watching a miracle. I hate calling it a miracle because scientists don't like talking about miracles. And it's not a miracle, actually. It's like, you know, it's science. Like, this is science and medicine actually changing people's lives, right? But I did those surgeries because I could record from their brain during that surgery, and I could actually get EEG from inside of the head. So it was a really sort of awesome opportunity to get direct brain activity. But, you know, I started sort of seeing the power of this brain stimulation stuff. I was like, obviously this thing that the Dalai Lama was talking about, like, you can change the brain, you can change someone's life. Like, clearly I was seeing that happen. But I got really fascinated with, like, could you do this without surgery? You know, the surgery is really messy, and sometimes I would actually throw up because I something about seeing blood and guts and the brain exposed. I just couldn't handle it. I don't know what it is. And so I started really getting fascinated with this question of could you use like strong magnets or electricity somehow from outside of the head, but get those same effects where you could drastically change a Parkinson's patient's life.
So this is the non-invasive part of your research.
Yeah, so there's this whole field of brain stimulation called non-invasive brain stimulation or non-invasive neuromodulation. And you can use really strong focused magnets. You can use electrical current. Or in my own research, we've been using focused ultrasound. So really high frequency ultrasound, you can transmit it into the brain from outside the head without any surgeries, anything, and you could actually get the energy into the brain to change the brain's activity. And so, you know, this was just sort of a thing I did for fun in graduate school because I guess I didn't like to sleep and I needed more projects. And so I just started sort of researching this brain stimulation stuff. And it turns out that Stuart Hameroff, who's also at the University of Arizona, he runs the Center for Consciousness Studies. So this is this thing that was running this consciousness conference I was telling you about. And Stuart had also gotten interested in ultrasound. He's the person who introduced me to this technology, actually. And Stuart and I started working together. We started doing ultrasound experiments on humans, trying to actually make people feel better. Hmm. So the idea was, if we could put ultrasound into parts of the brain that deal with mood and emotion, can we actually make people just happier, calmer, you know, less anxiety, that kind of stuff? And if we can do that in healthy people, can we actually do that in depressed people or people with anxiety disorder or PTSD or something like that? So we actually tried to start developing these interventions for mood disorders and depression. And it turns out we could. We could actually just take a healthy undergraduate from the undergraduate psychology courses, bring him into the experiment, put some ultrasound into their brain, and the majority of people actually just felt happier for like a short amount of time. So then we were like, oh, this is really cool. This is interesting. And now we've sort of started trying to develop that into an intervention for depression and anxiety.
So can you explain that a little bit more in concrete terms? So someone would come to the lab, an undergraduate at University of Arizona, and you would apply something to their brain. What is an instrument? What is it? What does it look like? So people can have a visual of what you're doing when someone comes into the lab to get this non-invasive brain stimulation.
Sure. So yeah, they come into the lab. We have a little lab that looks like a clinical setup, so kind of like going to a psychiatrist or psychologist. They come in, we do some tests on them to look at sort of their baseline brain activity or baseline sort of behavioral functioning. And then the device is a little round transducer. So the transducer is like what you would use to look at the fetus of a pregnant mother. You put it on the stomach, and you put some of that ultrasound gel, and you rub it all over the stomach.
I see. Okay.
So it's similar to that, and it's actually this, a similar level of energy that you would put into a fetus. So it's safe. You know, we know how long you can do it before it's not safe anymore and that kind of stuff. And this little thing is a little wearable thing they put on their head. They only wear it for 30 seconds. We don't want to put too much energy into the brain, of course. And they basically just sit there. We ultrasound into their brain for 30 seconds, and then we take it off. And then either we collect brain activity again to see if their brain's changed, or we give them some type of task to measure their mood. So it's pretty simple, and that's what's kind of powerful about this technology is that you could make these devices pretty easily. You could scale them. You could make millions of them if they really worked, and you could put them in clinics and hospitals and ultimately, you could even have one at home someday. You know, you just put it on your head and you feel a little different. So I got, you know, just sort of, I started seeing the power of this technology and really understanding the power of being able to reach inside of someone's brain and temporarily change their brain activity so they could feel different or behave a little differently. I started sort of seeing the clinical applications of this. But at the same time, I kept meditating and I kept seeing that meditation was clearly changing my brain because I was having a change to my internal world, you know, and I was less anxious. I've been giving talks on stages now in front of like hundreds of people. I gave a talk a month ago in front of like 500 people. And I would never have been able to do that, you know, 5 years ago, right before I was meditating. So, you know, I started thinking, okay, wait a minute. What was that thing the Dalai Lama said? You know, the thing I really got interested in the first place?
Yeah.
And I started sort of putting all of my experience together and thinking, okay, wait a minute. I think this is possible to use this non-invasive brain technology to stimulate or inhibit parts of the brain that are involved in meditation. And wait a minute, can I do that? Can I do that thing that the Dalai Lama said needs to be done? And so, you know, I kind of did a little experiment here or there with the ultrasound device, and it turns out, actually, you know, if you get ultrasounded to a part of your brain while you're meditating, people actually felt like it helped. Mm. So, you know, then I got super excited. At the same time, I started meditating with this meditation teacher called Shinzen Young. And Shinzen is a famous Western meditation teacher who has a true geeky side. He's a sort of, I don't want to call him a layman scientist because he's not a trained scientist, but if you talk to him, he sounds like it. He's got okay. knowledge and background of a trained scientist. So he's somewhere in between that. And also a Buddhist monk, so he's got all the, you know, background in Buddhism and other religions as well. He's really a fascinating guy. And Shinzen, it turns out, had been making the same proclamation that the Dalai Lama had made. He was saying, look, if you can find some intervention, you can boost meditation. He called it a techno boost. You can create a techno boost with brain technology, and you can boost people way into their meditation practice. So, you know, he had been talking about this for probably as long as I've been alive, honestly. I got hooked up with him somewhere along the way just because I was, you know, talking about all this stuff and started down this path. And for about the past year, Shinzen and I have been seriously experimenting with this technology. So we are taking meditators into the lab. And we're using focused ultrasounds and non-invasive brain stimulation during meditation. So the way this looks is we actually have a Zafu. So the Zafu is like the little pillow that meditators like to sit on.
Yeah.
I have that in my lab. It's like the marriage of East and West, right? You see this kind of science fiction, you know, sci-fi looking science lab. Right?
Any pictures of that anywhere? Can you share a picture with me?
I can't share a picture yet. I need to put those on my website. I have a bunch of pictures, but I haven't uploaded them. But sure, I can put one on my website, and you can link to that.
Okay.
We've got Shinzen. He wears normal Western clothes, but sometimes he wears like a cover or a blanket over him in the lab because he gets cold. So I've got these awesome pictures where he's like meditating on the Zafu with an ultrasound on his head. And he's got this, like, it looks like a shawl, the blanket, you know, over him. And it really just looks like Eastern meets Western.
Yeah.
So it's really very cool. And, you know, basically what we found over the past year is that, actually, to our surprise, you can use this brain stimulation technology to put someone in a very deep meditation state.
Wow.
So what that means is that if you meditate, say you go to a retreat, you go up in Santa Fe, you go up on top of a mountain and meditate in one of these little huts, you know, or something like that, and you do that for 2 weeks, after about, you know, 7 or 8 days, you might start experiencing these very deep states of stable attention, or what they call, like, joy. Your body will have little vibrational joy, and you'll just feel really good and really stable, and you don't have a lot of like negative voices in your head telling you you're stupid and everything is stupid that you're doing, and you know, you're just in that very kind of what you imagine a meditator to be in. That takes a long time typically for people to get into those states, and it turns out with the brain stimulation stuff, when we take meditators who have already experienced that and we bring them into the lab, they can just jump into those states like pretty quickly.
Oh, wow. So they need to have had practice before they can get there, but they can get there very quickly with this technology you're developing.
It seems like it.
Okay, it seems like it.
You know, we've only done this on experienced meditators like Shinzen because there's a little bit of an ethical component. You know, let's take an example like psychedelics, which are becoming very popular again. If you take a psychedelic, which I don't recommend, but they're fascinating. If you take a psychedelic, you know, you can have a very deep transformative experience of your consciousness very quickly, you know, over minutes to hours. Actually, what's going on in psychedelic research is they're finding that if you're in a psychologist clinic, if you're going to see the psychologist and you do psychedelics in that setting, it's actually very healing. If you have a lot of trauma, if you, like, so for example, PTSD war vets, they're doing a study on them. And if you do it in the right setting that's safe and controlled, you know, you can have, quote, a good trip. But if you just do it at a rave and, you know, you're not prepared, or you're at a concert and just go in the woods and it's scary, like, you can have a very bad experience.
Okay.
And that's why I don't just recommend it to anybody. It's got to be, you got to have mental preparation. And so this, I think something sort of similar could happen with what we're trying. We're sort of deeply altering someone's sense of self and their ego process, in quote, ego process. And so we wanted to be very careful in the beginning. We wanted people who already have experience with those changes, just in case something kind of scary happens, right, to their ego. But the plan now that this is working, or seems to be working, in our advanced meditators, is now we're going to take people who are slightly less advanced, and we're just going to go down the level of experience until we feel confident that we could do it in completely naive people. And it might be the case, I mean, this is why it's so great to do this within the context of science, is we can carefully study all of this before diving in. You know, unlike, you know, LSD, for example, in the 1960s, you know, Timothy Leary, for all of the great stuff he did, he was kind of reckless, right, with the drugs. And they became illegal, and it actually, in my view, kind of hurt the research end. Because, you know, they didn't take the time, and they didn't really have the wisdom back then to sort of carefully and methodically control and study everything to see how it would work for people. You know, they just invented, you know, they went on a bus and gave LSD to people and had Woodstock, you know, all those things happened, which were beautiful and great, but, you know, it's not the right sort of fully responsible context to do this in.
Yes, the snowball approach to gathering subjects, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, you know, and the 1960s happened, and now here we are today, but now we can sort of learn from that, and we can say, okay, if we truly have a technology that can do something on that level, like deeply and profoundly change someone's consciousness and sense of self, now we can put that in the context of science and clinical practice, and we can do it slowly and responsibly to see how people respond. And then once we understand how people respond to it, then we can start including different groups, or we can start trying people who have less experience with meditation, for example. Or in my case, you know, I think this sort of meditation plus brain stimulation stuff that we're developing, I think it would be very useful for depression or anxiety, maybe even opioid addiction. You know, you can take people who are addicted to drugs, you can put them through a meditation protocol while they're getting brain stimulation, and you may help them with the sort of deep psychological stuff that's going on that's leading to the addiction in the first place.
Yeah, they can step over the bridge themselves with the assistance and then get to get the other side. Well, this is incredible. Jay, thanks so much for being on the show, and thanks for sharing your wisdom. We'll put all the links that you want to share with us on the post, so people can access those things and track your research and follow the things you're sharing with the human race, you know, more broadly. Anyway, thanks again, Jay, for being on the show today, and have a good afternoon.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I'll say to any of your listeners out there who are in the position where they're thinking about graduate school or higher education, definitely email me or anybody else like me who you admire their work, or you like their work, or whatever. Get them input for them, you know, because that will help guide you to sort of finding the right path. Get as much input as possible before you make a big decision like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, Jay. Brain stimulation and meditation. Check out more Dr. Z podcasts at drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding. The People Behind the PhDs is conceived, written, produced, and edited by Dr. Z, that's me, Zachary Brooks, PhD, in Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts. Learn more at drz.net/about. That's dr-z.net/about.